Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Anthony Peake as we talk about opening the doors of perception, questions, and stories. You heard mine. Maybe we'll hear yours when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Anthony Peake with us. We'll get to your calls in a second. Anthony, let's talk a little bit about deja vu. Last summer, I was at an event called Contact in the Desert, and it was in an area called Joshua Tree, California. Kind of mystical. But I have not had deja vu episodes in years. That trip, which was a weekend out there in the desert, I must have had 6 different deja vu occurrences. It was to the point where I was beginning to wonder if I had some kind of tumor in my head. It was really weird. What do you think caused all that?
That's interesting. Were they precognitive deja vu experiences? Or were
Some of them were. By that I mean I knew what event was going to occur or that I had been there before. It was a combination of those.
I would conclude that what had happened there, that was obviously a very big event for you. And for some reason, your memories or the memory recordings or whatever we'd like to call them were much more intense at that period. Because one of the things that fascinates me, and I know it fascinates my associate, Dr. Arthur Funkhauser, who, by the way, if anybody's interested in deja vu, check out Art Funkhauser's website, because he does a survey on deja vu experiences and collects them from around the world. So please, if anybody wants to contact me on my website or on Facebook, I can send you the contacts for Art's survey. But Art argues that, and this is a very intriguing thing, George, is that deja vus are related to dreams in the sense that you've had a dream recently and in real life you start to experience the contents of the precognitive dream.
Whether you remember it or not, right?
Exactly, because this is the thing about dreams, isn't it? We don't really remember them that well, but we'll suddenly have something will trigger the fact that I've dreamt this before, or somebody will trigger the fact you've just had a dream. But this is more intense for you, isn't it? Because there was a rooted series of dreams. Now, Art argues, and I find it quite interesting as well, is sometimes the whole thing about deja vus is they're very, very mundane. It's not as if it's a kind of somebody's come and told you your family's been wiped out in an earthquake. It's normally something really just normal. You know, you see a tree and you go, I've seen that tree before. Or somebody will say something to you. And I think this is because, and this I think proves the reliving your life things, because the things are so mundane. I'm writing a book at the moment on the British writer J.B. Priestley, and he was influenced by a writer called J.W. Dunn, who wrote a book in 1927 called An Experiment with Time. And in that, Dunn argues that all precognitions are dreams orientated. We dream things, then we precognize them. But I call them mundane Duns. These kind of weird precognitions or these weird deja vus that don't really mean anything. But I think the pattern is, and clearly they were rooted there. There were a lot of them. So obviously Joshua Tree was very important to you. Now, to play devil's advocate, it could be that you had been there before and you were just recognizing things that you'd been there previously.
Yeah, I've been there several times.
Can you give an example of any particular one of the deja vus that we could discuss so we could get an idea?
Just these feelings of you've been here before, you know what's going to happen in an hour. It was just a strange little feeling that just wasn't a normal occurrence. It was a slow build, Anthony. You could just feel it in your system. It wasn't like, you know how like a panic attack comes on? You can feel something weird. It was almost like that, but obviously not a panic attack.
Well, funny enough, George, my sister was at that event, and she saw you.
Ah, okay, great.
which is really quite odd, isn't it? Because she lives in Canada, and she was over in the UK recently, and we were in North Wales. We were discussing me doing the show, and she mentioned, she said, I saw George. And I thought, woo, so there's a little bit of a synchronicity almost.
Yeah.
Because I think synchronicities are involved in this as well. You know, it's not just deja vu sensations, it's synchronicities.
Well, and as soon as we left the Joshua Tree area, that desert area, it didn't happen again. I was fine.
Mm. As you say, you sometimes think, is it neurological? Because it is linked. I don't know if you know, but deja vu sensations, if people have recurring deja vu sensations, they will immediately check them out for temporal lobe epilepsy. It's one of the signs that you have temporal lobe epilepsy. And it's also linked to migraine. So clearly, the doors of perception for these individuals are open to such an extent that deja vus become more and more profound.
Interesting. I don't get migraines at all, thank God. But this one was weird. It really was. It's just a strange feeling.
It's as if somebody's walked over your grave, isn't it? And that's the whole thing about the Ephron hypothesis, the 1961 Robert Ephron hypothesis, the visual pathways, does not explain the feeling you get. And also, it cannot explain, it's 0.5 of a second, but George, you were obviously having an experience that was longer than just as if you were seeing 0.5 of a second.
Yes,
future, wasn't it?
Much longer, and many of them. You know, six of them that lasted 30 seconds apiece, maybe.
Well, there is an argument, and I discuss this in my first book, Is There Life After Death, that there is a delay of perception, that about 0.5 of a second, we are 0.5 of a second behind what's happening outside.
Yes.
And the brain buffers information before it presents it.
Yeah, sometimes it overlaps.
Yes. It's like the car door. If you're in a garage, an underground garage with cars, and somebody slams a car door, there is a certain point where there's a delay between you seeing the door closing and you hearing the sound, because, of course, light wave travels faster than sound wave.
Mm-hmm.
But up until a certain point, the brain buffers the information so that you still see it as concurrent, which, again, is intriguing, isn't it?
It sure is. Let's go to the phones. Thomas is in La Jolla, California. Welcome to the show, Thomas. Go ahead.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. And Anthony Peake, I look forward to reading your books. Absolutely fascinating. My question, well, let me give a comment first, a little bit of history.
All right.
Timothy Leary wrote a memoir 30 years ago called Flashback. And in this memoir called Flashback, he revealed, well, he said that LSD-25 was street legal till 1966. Here in America. And he knew Mary Pinkoat Meyer in the early 60s while Timothy Leary was still a Harvard professor. Mary Pinkoat Meyer was the estranged wife of CIA operative Cord Meyer, very high level operative in the CIA, worked with Alan Dulles, later in the Watergate break-ins, worked with G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, etc., the White House plumbers. But anyway, Mary Pinkoat Meyer was estranged from Cord Meyer, and she was aware of Timothy Leary's work in the early 60s, and she got the idea. She was a Washington socialite at the time, and she got the idea that she wanted to give LSD-25 to several high-level politicians in Washington, D.C., okay? And, of course, it was street legal,
mm-hmm.
early 60s. And so Timothy Leary coached her. He said, look, you can't just slip it into their drinks or anything. You have to be ethical, and you have to use what he called set and setting and prepare them for what could be a very radical drug experience. Okay, so Mary Pinkoat Meyer arranged with Sandoz Pharmaceuticals of Switzerland to obtain pharmaceutical-grade LSD-25, and she and several other women proceeded to guide several Washington politicians through guided psychotropic experiences in the early 60s, okay? Now, Meyer told, Mary Pinkoat Meyer told Timothy Leary that she was having an affair with a very, very high-level politician. Tim Leary asked her, well, who is the politician? She says, I can't tell you. Okay. And she said that she had given this politician, who she was having, being also intimate with, LSD-25 and guiding him under the Leary protocol of set and setting in each of the trips, so to speak. After John Kennedy's assassination, she revealed to Tim Leary that, in fact, the high-level politician was, in fact, President Kennedy, mm-hmm. who had just been assassinated. And she told Tim Leary that she was afraid for her life, that she was going to be killed, because Kennedy had told her very many high-level secrets. And 6 months later, Mary Pinkhope Meyer, in broad daylight on the street, was murdered.
Jeez.
Okay. And Tim Leary wrote about this in his memoir, Flashback, and it's also been written about by Robert Anton Wilson. There's been a book recently published called Mary's Mosaic by Pete Janey that also discusses this. But anyway, Mary Pinkhope Meyer told Tim Leary that John Kennedy, well, she conducted over 30 LSD experiences with John Kennedy, many of them in the White House. And she said John Kennedy, now remember, it was street legal at the time she was giving, you know, LSD-25 to politicians. And she said John Kennedy had a very profound experience and basically told her, I'm realizing that I'm president, but that I have no power. Now, assuming that this is true, okay, and the details also, like in the book Mary's Mosaic, the implications are profound, because if you think of the last 2 years of Kennedy's life before he was assassinated, he wanted to pull out of Vietnam. He wanted to undermine the Federal Reserve banking cartel. He even, according to E. Howard Hunt, in E. Howard Hunt's confessions to his son, wanted to reveal the alien presence, the extraterrestrial presence, etc. So I guess my question for you, Anthony, is what would be the implications? I mean, now LSD-25, synthetic mescaline, ketamine, DMT, all of that is illegal. And but what would be the implications of high-level politicians, presidents, prime ministers, etc., being given ethically conducted psychotropic experiences with substances such as LSD-25, synthetic mescaline, synthetic psilocybin, and would that be valuable, you know, in terms of their experience? That's my question.
Okay. Well, that's a fascinating question, and thank you for that.
And a great story, too.
Absolutely. There's some very interesting background details there. Now, I'm immediately thinking along the lines of the reasons in 1991 when Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico was a government-funded research into the effects of dimethyltryptamine. And again, it was intriguing as to why they decided to do that. And in fact, that eventually wound down. And we now know that DMT is street illegal now at the moment in the USA and most Western countries. But if people in political power have their doors of perception opened, it would mean we would start to politics would change, because one of the things that tends to occur with people when they take hallucinogenic substances and entheogens is they discover, for want of a better term, the God within, because the word entheogen actually means the God within. So it's kind of, you discover something that there's the unitary nature of humanity, that we are all one single consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. Now, I'm quoting Bill Hicks there from one of his very, very famous comedy monologues, but it's a very, very powerful statement, because the idea is, as if we realize that each and every human being is effectively part of a greater organism, and that when you injure one person, you injure yourself, this is going to change completely the way in which we do politics. Suddenly, human beings cannot be demonized just because of their ethnicity or because of their beliefs, because they are all human beings. And in fact, you doing something to somebody will bounce back on you in one way or another. So if our politicians did do this worldview, I think it would change the world for the better, because then we could all progress collectively as humanity, which I think is going to be the next big seed change in terms of how the geopolitical and the sociological way the world is viewed. Either that, or we go down the route of hatred and everything else. And I think we're at a very crucial point in history at the moment, both scientifically, psychologically, sociologically, and economically. So thank you for that, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that little speech.
These drugs, Anthony, that put people in a different state of mind, enhance most of the time their abilities, or does it decrease?
That's open to debate, and this is one of the areas that I think proper research should be done to find out whether people can be more effective. Now, there were a series of experiments done in the 1960s it was one of the top hypnotists, whose name escapes me at the moment. It will come to me in a second. And they did a series of tests whereby they were able to hypnotize people to perceiving time at a slower rate, which, of course, we know with substances like ketamine, and we know with other hallucinatory substances, time seems to dilate, it seems to go slower. Now, if that is the case, it means that mentally people are more acute and can do much more thinking and ideas in a shorter period of time, which means we can develop things quicker, because we can drop out of time or move into a different time state and can think things through. That was Milton Erickson was the experimenter, by the way. I knew it would come to me if my brain went blank. So Milton Erickson. Mm-hmm. And Erickson discovered that, for instance, people would be able to design things quicker. They were able to count things quicker. Their perception levels were greater. So it does seem to enhance our abilities. Opening the doors does enhance our abilities to understand and appreciate the world around us. So I think that's something we could work on going forward.
Anthony, where do we get the book, Opening the Doors of Perception?
Right, okay. Well, you can get it on Amazon USA, Amazon Canada.
Okay, great.
It's on Amazon. It's in bookshops. It's distributed in America. So, you know, you can go to your local bookshop and you can order it. If you want a personalized copy, if you go onto my website, anthonypeak.com, you will find you can order the books, and I charge exactly the same as you would pay in bookshops. Just the thing is, with the states and areas, the cost of shipping is extortionately high, so it might put people off. But if you want a personalized copy, you can do it there. It's on Kindle. I'm just finishing doing an audiobook version of my first book. So the books are out there. You can get them. There is no problem. They are, and they sell very well in America.
All right, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And Anthony Peake with us, and we're going to come back and take final phone calls. Just fascinating discussion with him. Okay, welcome back. Anthony Peake with us, our final segment here. Let's go to Keith in Rochester, New York. Keith, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Mr. Norrie, you should know that Richard Serrett had the author of Mary's Mosaic on just 4 nights ago. That's
yep.
Where the previous caller got his long rendering there.
Yep.
I'd like to ask about absolute sensory perception and hyperreality. William Blake wrote about cosmic consciousness. He wrote in terms of Jesus and the Buddha. And for those of us who perceive that we might have cosmic consciousness, it's really, as I've ascertained it, an internal reservoir dynamo that allows you to pick up on just about everything that you encounter. In the same way that I love to read, I read people without bragging immaculately. I can pick up on their inherent personalities basically in the first 2 seconds of me being in their presence. So I'd like to ask the author, and I am in stark disagreement with the previous caller about all of the use of the drugs. I am proud to say that I, Keith, have never once used drugs. I've never smoked marijuana, and I have to think that the human body was not meant to have these outside substances pumped into it. Timothy Leary, long dead, and thankfully for that. I'll refer to Allen Ginsberg's long epic poem of Howl, where he said the best minds of our time had been caught up in this drug stupor, and that this whole idea of getting our world leaders hooked on drugs that is going to bring about some peaceful paradise. What about hyper-reality, which is what so many people choose not to involve themselves in, where they can just simply go out into the real world, face it head on without getting caught up in depression and feeling the need for drug use? What about, and I'm asking this in conclusion to the guests, what about just true cosmic consciousness that allows someone just to take in the whole world, breathe the world, and just know that when you're in the presence of people, that you know immediately what they are about, and in that way, sir, everyone becomes one and the same.
That's an interesting take, Anthony. What do you think of that?
Well, excellent, and a wonderful comment made by Keith there, I think, and quite an important one. The concept of cosmic consciousness is something I discuss in my books, and I have done over the years. First put together, you know, by Richard Morris Buck many, many years ago, and he wrote a book called Cosmic Consciousness. And it is the idea that you don't necessarily need artificial substances to open up the doors of perception. Now, in my book, The Infinite Mindfield, I argue that this can happen normally within the normal brain. And I suggest that the pineal gland actually generates endogenous, that is internally generated dimethyltryptamine, and that it excretes this dimethyltryptamine and crosses and goes across the brain. Now, you're probably aware that dimethyltryptamine, which Rick Strassman has argued is the modulator of reality, has been discovered in the liver, it's been discovered in the spinal fluid, it's been discovered in the blood. Most people will argue that DMT has never been discovered in the brain. Well, it has. Recent developments, a lady called Jimo Bojijin of the University of Michigan 3 years ago did a series of experiments, and she discovered in the pineal gland of live rats DMT.
In a natural form?
The actual form, yes. Now, this means that DMT is potentially a neurotransmitter. Now, we know this is possible because there's things called the trace amine-associated receptor sites, and the sigma-1 and sigma-2 receptor sites in the brain. These are receptor sites that seem to have been designed specifically to work with dimethyltryptamine. We also know that dimethyltryptamine is very, very similar to melatonin, and melatonin we know is released by the pineal gland. Now, if this is the case, it means that we can generate our own entheogens inside our own brains, which could then explain why people can have extraordinary experiences, like possibly Keith is describing here, without the need to actually take ayahuasca, without the need to take peyote, mescaline, or whatever, because we can do it naturally. The issue is how we work this forward, and again, this is something I'm trying to work with neurologists, I'm trying to work with neurochemists, to really pursue this. Because I think there is an awful lot of work that needs to be done. Now, I know Rick Strassman is doing some excellent work. An associate of mine called Beach Barrett down in Asheville in North Carolina is doing some interesting work on this as well. So we're on a potential breakthrough here, that there is a linkage. So in my books and in this new book, this is what I argue, that you can have the dangerous substances, but it's rather like going to a place where you don't have the map. In other words, individuals like people who do dream yoga and people who do deep meditation spend years shamans, for instance, they spend years training themselves to be able to go into these altered states of consciousness. These other substances catapult you there straight away, but you don't know how to deal with it. So it's not at all surprising that people go crazy. So it's very important to realize that we can probably try to work on generating our own internally generated entheogens.
Let's go to Jason in Syracuse, New York now. Jason, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having my call, George.
Sure thing.
Anthony. I'm 45 now. Ever since I was younger, about 16, I've had these, similar to what you're talking about tonight, these feelings like you've lived in another life before, you've gone through it, you have all this deja vu. And throughout my life, I've been trying to explain it and research it. I've done astral projection, remote viewing, a lot of these things. And just recently, within the last couple of years, I've been experiencing these phenomenon where, I'll have these visions that'll come into my mind, these visions, and then lo and behold, minutes later, they manifest. And on many occasions, I actually showed my son once how I was able to do this. I said, let's play a game in the morning. And throughout the day, when I was with him, I said, I'm going to explain something or tell you something minutes ahead of when it's going to happen, and we'll see if it happens. So throughout the day, I was kind of demonstrating this to him, and it was kind of freaking him out. Huh. And I've done it with my wife as well. And when I actually first met my wife, I did a little trick. I said, I want to do something, it's weird because sometimes I can control it, sometimes I can't. It comes in intermittently. So it's interesting because it's kind of mind-blowing, but on the same sense, it kind of makes sense to what you're talking about.
You could be the white crow that we've been looking for, in the sense that a white crow is somebody that can actually do something that is different. Now, I've been searching for years, and I work closely with other researchers, people like Graham Nichols, who trains people in out-of-the-body experiences, and there's a group of us, Dr. Penny Satori, who works on near-death experiences. What we would love to be able to do is to find somebody who can not necessarily control these abilities to precognize information, but under certain circumstances can do so, because that would be worth $1 million to us, that we could prove categorically that people can perceive the future. We know they can, but as you rightly say, they are so intermittent, you can't make them happen. You know, it's like out of the body experiences. People can't spontaneously get outside of their body, and I've never found anybody who can spontaneously do it, from Ingo Swan to anybody else. I don't know of anybody that can do it spontaneously, go into the next room, find information and bring it back. I don't disagree that they can't do it, but what we need to do is to prove it scientifically. Of course, we'd start the argument, they'll turn around and say it's coincidence, it's attention bias, it's God knows what else. But the reality is we need somebody like you to work with in terms of this. Now, I'm interested here because what it seems is you go into a state that is technically known as hypnagogia, where it's a kind of a liminal state whereby you are kind of semi-dreaming. And the imagery from your dream consciousness superimposes itself on three-dimensional reality. Now, this clearly, because I believe that hypnagogic imagery is precognitive, because I believe many dreams are precognitive. So that is absolutely fascinating. And if your son or your wife would be willing to sign documentation to say that these things happened, that's really brilliant for us. So maybe contact me on Facebook or something like that, and I'd be interested to talk to you more about this. Thank you.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it? Great research.
Oh, totally. That's all we need. Like these children who, the autistic children that can actually see the future. This is gold for parapsychologists. This is something that we really need, because we have to prove these things empirically. As Marcello Trulli quite rightly said, the plural of anecdote, no, extreme claims need extreme proofs. And also the statement, the plural of anecdote is not proof. Very much so. But when so many people experience these things, it is bad science to just ignore them because it doesn't fit in with your model.
Luke is in Wyoming. Welcome to the program. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, George. How's life?
Life is good. Thanks.
It is strange. It is like this culmination of events that is about to take place, and you can feel it. Bizarre.
It's out there.
So it's unnerving, is it not?
Well, what's unnerving is we don't know what it is.
Right, right. What it really was, like an apex moment that was going to, and not necessarily wake people up, but snap you out of it altogether, pull you out of the concept of existing in a reality with people and be out of control of it.
Let's ask Anthony if he senses something, because so many people do, Anthony, with this cosmic awareness.
They do. We have to be careful here, because most generations feel that, you know, there is something in the air, there's a change. You know, we had the revivalism in the 1850s in America and everything else. So there is always this kind of sensation that this is the time for change. I think the difference now is that we have the technology in order to appreciate and understand the idea that external reality could be an illusion. The reason I'm saying this is that in previous generations, my generation and probably yours, George, as well, is that we didn't have the tools to understand. We didn't have computer games. We didn't have things like the Oculus Rift that can place us into three-dimensional realities and simulated realities. So we can understand that we process information, and the reality we perceive is an inwardly generated facsimile of what is outside. So, for instance, if somebody places an Oculus Rift on their head and they're in a feedback suit and they go into a virtual reality simulation on their computer, they cannot tell whether that is reality or this reality. Now, it means that we can now, there's things we can hang our ideas on. We can talk to the new generation coming forward and say, do you understand how it could be a simulation? Early generations would not understand. We do now. We have the technology to do this. So I think the change is coming through slowly because we are starting to think differently. We see the universe in a different way. We understand about dark matter. Well, we don't understand dark matter, but we know it's there. We understand the mysteries of quantum physics. We understand non-locality. We understand the wave-particle duality problems the quantum physics have. And all of these are pointing towards a paradigm change. And the paradigm change is en route. It is on its way, and there will be a discovery in science that will break everything open, just as in December 1900, when Max Planck stood up in Berlin and turned around and said that energy comes in quanta, which changed everything. And then 5 years later, Einstein comes along with his theory of relativity. We are about to have this kind of breakthrough, and the breakthrough will be consciousness and something discovered about how consciousness, in how the brain can create consciousness. And I'm very, very excited about this.
Okay, next up, let's go to Mary in Hollywood, Florida. Mary, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
I had a situation some time ago. To make a long story short, at the end of World War II, my family, we lived up in New York, went down to Times Square, and everybody was celebrating. For some apparent reason, my mother lost me for 20 minutes. And she said she went through torture until she was able to find me. Now, later on in my life, I would be coming home from school. I didn't want to go to school. I went to the library. When I came back, I passed by somebody coming down in the stairwell in the apartment building, and in my pillowcase, he had all the belongings I had there. Another time, I would be driving my car, and then a gut feeling told me, please, please be very, very careful. Be very careful. Move to the next lane, which I did. There was an obstacle in front of me, only a block away.
She saved
you.
Another
time, it kept coming. I met a special lady. Her name is Lori G. She was receiving messages from the Lord and the Blessed Mother, and she wrote them down. The home office is now in Deerfield, Florida. It's on the internet. Somebody wants to check it out. But she always told me, listen to your inner gut. And then one time, 9 years ago, I woke up. I couldn't sleep. I'm listening and listening to myself. Whoever it was, told me how to go in my purse, take the $20 bills, throw them one way, $10 bills another way, and be very careful, be very careful. So anyhow, even told me how to take everything out of my purse and be careful. So anyhow, the following morning, I went to throw the garbage out. I lived behind an apartment house. And A man came at me with a Saturday Night Special. My life went through me for that, for 1 minute and 20 seconds. And that was incredible.
How'd you get out of it, Mary?
Well, I have a heart problem. I started to faint, and the guy says, "Are you okay?" And I go, "No, I have a heart problem." And he cut out.
He ran, huh?
So anyhow, you know,
you say that your life went through you. Did you see your whole life in a flashback?
Yes. Minute and 20 seconds, my whole life flashed in front of me.
Did you see it as a kind of your whole life in time, or did it just seem, you saw it super fast?
Synchronized.
Super fast.
Yeah.
Okay, Mary, thanks. We're almost out of time. Thanks. Anthony, why do things go by in that kind of speed?
This is interesting. In my first book, Is There Life After Death? The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die, I was a member of the International Association of Near-Death Studies, and my first book, The Foreword, was written by Professor Bruce Grayson. And in that book, I am fascinated by some of the Grayson scales, which are the things people use in terms of analyzing near-death experiences. And one of the Grayson scales is what's called a panoramic life review. And it's the classic my life flash before my eyes. Now, what I believe is happening here is that when you get towards the end of your life and your higher self, your daemon, whatever you want to call it, thinks you're going to die, it actually rewinds and runs your life again.
And it does it in rapid fashion. Anthony, we're out of time. Thank you so much. The name of the book, Opening the Doors of Perception. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.